Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now. And sometimes it can be hard to cut through all the noise from the Canberra bubble. But on the Politics Now podcast, bursting it wide open is our core business. I'm joined by the brightest minds at the ABC to break down the poly-speak and have a chat about what's actually going on behind the scenes. It's called Politics Now, and you can find it on ABC Listen.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In a home in Syria under the control of ISIS, a young Yazidi woman says she was kept as a slave in the home of two Australian women who just returned. This is the core of a crime against humanity charge that is working its way through the Melbourne courts at the moment. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Just a heads up, there is some graphic language in this episode. This is the case of the ISIS brides.
Dozens of Australian women either chose to or were forced to travel to Syria as the wives of ISIS fighters.
These are the people Australia doesn't want, all held in the infamous Al Hol camp in Syria.
If you make your bed, you lie in it. These are people who went overseas supporting Islamic State.
Six women landed in Sydney and Melbourne late yesterday with 13 children.
Victorian Joint Counter-Terrorism Team have arrested a 53-year-old woman who will be charged tonight or tomorrow with enslavement.
Why did you marry an ISIS terrorist?
Keep moving.
Why should we trust you?
Of the dozen or so women who've become known as the ISIS brides, four have been charged with terror offences or crimes against humanity, with two women accused of owning a slave in Syria. The court process has started, and last week in the Melbourne Magistrates Court was James Oughton. Welcome back, James.
Thanks for having me again.
Always a pleasure. Appreciate your insight and your knowledge of what's unfolded here. I think, you know, what's happened in the Melbourne Magistrates Court over the last couple of weeks has been really interesting, learning about the kind of first time that, you know, crimes against humanity charges have been tried in Australia and what that looks like, the bail process we're working through at the moment. And kind of central to this process is a young Yazidi woman who says she was kept as a slave by two Australian women in Syria. She says she was bought by the Ahmads, Muhammad Ahmad, the patriarch of this family who traveled to Syria with Khorsa Ahmad, his wife. She's the person whose bail application I was in over the last few days. And they're the parents of Zainab Ahmad, who you were following the bail application of last week. I want to talk about this young Yazidi woman, James. How does she say she was treated by this family?
Well, horribly is an understatement. Going to the allegations here, first of all, the Ahmad families, we've heard from the courts here, they entered Syria as a large unit, both the patriarch and the matriarch of the household, Muhammad and Khorsa, with their children, adult children, and then husbands and so on, in 2015. Now, police have put to the courts that they actually were raising money in 2014 from Turkey. They set up a charity, and police suspect the money used for that charity is used to fund the whole family's movement into Syria from Turkey.
Right.
The charges that we're dealing with here relate to a period from 2017 to 2018, and what police have alleged in the court is that the father, Muhammad, purchased this Yazidi teenager for $10,000 at around the time of Ramadan in 2017. And she was in the household until late 2018. In the AFP statement of facts, which is essentially a summary of everything that they're alleging here and a timeline of events, they say that she was traded and trafficked 17 times during this period when Islamic State were in control of large areas of Syria and Iraq.
And the Ahmad family are one of those 17 times.
Ahmad family are allegedly one of those families. The father told this Yazidi teenager, according to the statement of facts, that he had purchased her to be raped and he had purchased her to do house chores. And that was pretty standard. These people were considered property. They were married to the men, and the men could do as they pleased under Islamic State. And it was, while there were kind of slight modifications in how the slaves were treated, overwhelmingly, they were just considered property for the men to do as they please.
Yeah. what this young Yazidi woman says happened is pretty horrendous. You know, when I was in court earlier this week, I think about, she might have been Friday last week, when the statement of facts was being read through, there was a school group in the room, and the magistrate actually stopped the informant from reading out the section of the statement of facts where the young Yazidi woman says she is raped by Muhammad Ahmad, so they could leave the room at that point. There's also other assaults throughout that period as well, including a time where I think she says she was grabbed by her hair and dragged down a set of stairs. Is that right?
Yeah, that's in the statement of facts as well, and that's been read out to the court as well. They're alleging the father did physically abuse her as well as sexually abuse her, including dragging her down the stairs. There is a slight difference then, obviously, with the mother of that household, Corsa, versus the children. Obviously, we've been following the case of Zainab Ahmed. It's alleged that when the father purchased this Yazidi slave for $10,000, he's then taken her to meet the wife, Corsa, and then she has approved the sale, saying, yep, she will do, essentially. Mm. So that's what makes Corsa's charges, from what we know so far, a little more serious. She's facing three charges as opposed to two of the daughter. Mm. But during this period as well, the complainant or the alleged victim here has said that, has described Zainab Ahmed as like the, quote, deputy of the house. So the allegations against Zainab Ahmed is not that she physically assaulted the girl, but that she did order her around, prevented her from leaving the home and mistreated her badly, but no allegations there of physical assault from Zainab Ahmed.
James, we haven't heard from the young Yazidi woman who's the complainant in this, not personally in court. Who has spoken to her? Where are we getting her version of events and this story from?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, there is a suppression order on revealing her, given that the allegations here against, you know, relating to sexual violence and so on. Mm. And she was a minor as well at the same time. There's a lot of details we don't fully know about the actual investigation for two reasons. First of all, this is a bail hearing that we've had with Zainab Ahmed and then obviously with Corsa, the mother. That's not really a time to start examining all the evidence in detail. The way these things go is, first of all, the bail hearing is primarily about understanding the charges and then using essentially a risk assessment tool to work out whether or not bail should be granted. Later down the process, then you have a committal hearing, which is where a magistrate does assess the evidence at what is available and then makes a decision whether or not the evidence that is available is satisfactory for the case to go to trial. And, you know, presuming along this whole way the accused is still defending themselves, then you end up with a trial where the jury will actually make a decision as well. So that takes time. So this is not really the time things are going to be tested thoroughly in the evidence.
James, you know, we've been talking through here the bail hearings of Zainab and Corsa Ahmed. Zainab's bail hearing or bail application kind of wrapped up last week. You were there. Her bail was refused. Why was that?
So federal police have spelt out, and the prosecution have alleged in the court, is that, first of all, she showed clear and repeated support for Islamic State during some years that she was there. You know, they've said that there's photo evidence, there's social media posts, all this stuff that shows the family moving within this territory controlled by Islamic State, and repeated posts from her gloating about Islamic State success, or gloating that only a few Australians who had gone there had actually gone back, and, you know, make of that as you will, essentially saying everyone who's come here, or almost everyone who's come here, still loves Islamic State or still supports them. And the defence never questioned that it was her making these social media posts. Mm. And from that, then they've then said that there's been no renunciation of that ideology since then. Mm. Therefore, they just don't know what kind of a threat she still poses. And they've made another argument. She was married three times, three different husbands. Her first husband that she traveled with died. Mm. And then, as we discussed in the first episode, women were expected to marry. So she married again and again. Mm-hmm. They've even said that he's still alive somewhere, or suspected to be alive somewhere. He's not in the country. Mm. But even that itself, they've said that makes a connection.
Mm. In her not sort of renouncing Islamic State or ISIS, it's interesting because, you know, Zainab Ahmed did, through her counsel, sort of say she doesn't support that organisation anymore. It's not something she believes in and is a part of. The magistrate didn't buy that?
No, not strong enough. Too late, too little.
Okay.
Is a summary.
Yep.
And it, you know, it was interesting, and you know, I don't know if you can ever talk about court cases like you can politics with tactics and so on, but it is, you know, I did note that those comments that she now from defence detests Islamic State, she detests their ideology, really pushing the point that men were in control of women there, and she's learnt or she accepts that that is an evil way of doing things. Let's use that phrase.
Yep.
It wasn't pushed hard early, which, you know, there is a difference between that already and her mother Corso, and their defence team made that argument straight off the bat. And same with the one of the other women who's been charged, Rayan El-Houli. Again, defence made that argument very high off the bat. Now, ultimately, a magistrate, chief magistrate judge will accept all the evidence. Perhaps it doesn't matter so much about the order of the evidence. They don't quite work like we do in the media.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, what the chief magistrate here has said is those comments from Zainab Ahmed were only made after she was arrested and after she was separated from her young daughter. She has a young daughter who was born in the Syrian refugee camps. And so those comments did not hold as much weight, anywhere near enough weight, had perhaps she had made those comments far sooner before she was charged. Perhaps if she had spoken to Kurdish officials and made more social media posts. I don't know what her access to the phone was like in the camps, but it was too late, too little. Yep. That's the best way to summarise it.
Yeah, interesting talking about Corsair's legal team, her defence team, and the way they've handled her kind of renunciation of ISIS. Peter Morrissey, who's the barrister acting for her legal team, kind of went to the point that the statement she's made basically amount to ISIS sucks, quite literally his words in the magistrate's court, and that, you know, ISIS isn't an organisation that takes kindly to a renunciation. So if you are to renounce ISIS, then they're going to notice, and it's not going to be an organisation that's going to be kind of happily welcoming you back if that's somewhere that you do want to go. In Zainab's case, what were some of the reasons that the defence gave for her getting bail? Why did they say she should be released?
Well, I think first of all, one of the things that they did push back on the AFP and the prosecution was almost just saying it's ridiculous, this idea that she is still a threat. The AFP never went into detail, or the prosecution never went into detail about how she could be a threat or what she could potentially do here in Australia. First of all, she's obviously removed from Islamic State. Secondly, it's not the organisation it once was. You know, there's only remnants kind of it left. But, you know, there's still a terrorism threat. There are still people linked with it and spread its ideology and stuff. But they never went into any kind of detail about that. And as we've established here, they didn't have to convince the chief magistrate. But essentially the defence's argument was that, well, it's ridiculous. Of course, she doesn't pose a threat. But what they didn't bring forward was kind of any expert evidence yet to demonstrate those points. Okay. Now, with the mother, Corsa Ahmed, we did hear from a forensic psychologist who talked about the rate of recidivism amongst those who have conducted terrorist activity being incredibly low, so that you can see that they're pushing that point, that the rate that someone would actually reoffend is very low, statistically speaking. We know, for instance, from, you know, we talked in the first episode, Peter Lowe, an anti-violent extremism expert, you know, she has been involved in the repatriation programs with Iraq to bring back some 10,000 people who were linked with Islamic State. Not the actual fighters as much, but a lot of people who might have been involved or showed their support for them.
Yeah.
She was involved with Iraq from 2023 until the end of last year with the UN and Iraq. And what she said is most of those people come back, they do change their views. They have changed their views. You know, it can go both ways. Sometimes people go into kind of Syrian refugee camps and become more radicalized. But generally speaking, she told me that most do change their views. They've gone there with one idea of what it is or what it should be, and then leave that system with a very different mindset. And when they do come back to home, they just want to live a peaceful life.
Yep.
The other argument that they've made is the child that she has, saying that this is a girl who desperately needs her mum by her side. Now, again, this is a girl who grew up in the camps with her mum, and as we discussed in the first episode, how children can be impacted by those camps can vary greatly. Mm. This is making some broad comments before we go back into Zainab's Ahmed's case. But fundamentally, a mother in these circumstances can be can change the trajectory or outcomes of a child tremendously. If they show that love and support and education, it can really assist their rehabilitation. And for instance, with Mariam Raad's case, this is a case that has come in years prior, she did get bail because it was shown that there were problems in that rehabilitation if the mother was removed. And she did get bail to resume that kind of love and care and support that a child would need, especially one coming from these kind of traumatic situations. So that argument was put quite stridently in the court. But ultimately, while that was acknowledged by the chief magistrate, again, it just boiled down to that risk factor and that idea that your announcement that you actually don't like Islamic State, after all, is too little too late.
The thing that stuck with me from the chief magistrate's decision when denying Zainab Ahmed bail was, you know, when she was talking about the impact on her daughter, saying that, you know, almost despite what she has been through, she's in a pretty good mental state because of the parenting of Zainab throughout that. And, you know, citing the evidence that was given throughout the application that, you know, if her mother's not there, that her state will, you know, decline. That was just kind of confronting to hear throughout that. And then, you know, going on to make the decision that she won't be looking after this child while she awaits trial.
No, and she won't be. And as we know, this is a case that will likely run some years. You know, a final argument on that point was that the defence team was saying that this case will go for a very long period of time. They've made a couple of points, one of which is that they argued that this the allegations are against her on the lower side, especially like if we compare her to the father. They have spelt out that point I made before that women didn't really have any control or say in what was happening under Islamic State. It's kind of nudging at the idea. It's like, well, what did you expect her to be able to do in terms of like this slave couldn't leave the house, or what did you kind of expect her to do? So they've made points, for instance, that this is going to be a very long court case, given that all the witnesses or many witnesses and experts are overseas, and that'll take a long time. She has already spent time in the camps. They're kind of suggesting that should be taken into account, as, you know, when you spend time in jail, that's usually knocked off your sentence. I don't know how far that would ever go, but they said it must be taken into account. And then finally, on this issue of the child, they've said, when you take into account all these years that she'll spend, you know, incarcerated or in custody while awaiting for trial, that's a lot of years that she'll be without the child, when the child needs her mum by her side for that full rehabilitation potential. Even saying that ultimately if she is convicted, which we're a long way off getting anywhere near that because there's only a bail hearing, that the punishment might end up being shorter than the time in custody. But what the chief magistrate has said to that is that this is a first, crimes against humanity, these charges, but any notion or argument that this will be an exceptionally long legal process is just speculation. We just don't know.
So James, as we've been talking about, bail has been refused for Zainab Ahmed. The decision on whether or not Kawsar Ahmed will get bail is expected a bit later. I mean, if you look at, you know, the decision around Zainab, you know, the child hasn't been taken into account in a reason that she should get bail. She hasn't gotten bail even with that there. There's been evidence in Kawsar's bail application that she's much healthier and much happier when she is around family as well, but there's no one, you know, in the same sense as Zainab who is a dependent on her as well. So it will be interesting to see how the magistrate takes that into account. It, potentially, if you look at Zainab's decision, might be unlikely, but if that does happen, we'll have an update in the feed.
Well, it'll be higher bar because there are more charges. And again, as you've pointed out, with Zainab Ahmed, she does have that young girl.
Mm.
Of course, I can't make that same argument.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Corsair, you know, is dealing with some mental health impacts from this as well. There was a moment, I mean, there was a report put before the court around how she's coping at the moment, dealing with kind of complex PTSD, things like that. There was a point during the hearing where she actually left the dock without telling anyone. The hearing continued and the magistrate kind of highlighted that the applicant had disappeared, and, you know, it was explained that, you know, she's dealing with panic attacks and things like that, and that, you know, the prison guards that are there or the court security that's there kind of, you know, have a system to help her out if she's experienced one of them. So it was a short break while she came back in from that. So yeah, there's a lot that is kind of being worked through that the magistrate's kind of balancing in their mind as they're making, as she's making this decision. I mean, as well as Zainab and Corsair, we've also had Janai Safar in Sydney, one of these recent returnees who's had her bail refused, and then Rian Al-Houli still kind of working through the bail application there as well. And I mean, James, you mentioned Miriam Raad before, you know, one of the reasons that she got bail being that, you know, she had a child to look after. I mean, she was also convicted of entering one of these areas, but in the whole process spent that time on bail, she was in the community, and when she was convicted, she had no conviction recorded as well. Why the different kind of treatment, or why the reasoning even behind that?
Well, I mean, magistrates and judges and so on can make different rulings for starters, but you know, you'd have to boil down to that the seriousness of the allegations against Miriam Raad were not on the same extent for the Ahmeds here. Mm. As we've mentioned, she also, her defence team also made the arguments that she was not a threat. She needed to be there for the support of her young children.
Mm-hmm.
And bail was granted. And it, you know, could have been that maybe she's, because she spent time in the community, you can kind of track how they're behaving and moving as well, because the expert that I mentioned before, Peter Lowe, actually went to the household and was assessing how people were behaving and their ideology and all those kinds of things to make a risk assessment. That's her job. She makes risk assessments about what dangers or impacts and how people are coping. And she acknowledged that the children would benefit from the mother's support.
Mm.
And ultimately, yes, this Miriam Raad did get bail. She did plead guilty in entering a declared zone, which mm-hmm. is essentially the ISIS-controlled territory, but she did not receive a conviction. And an argument there, and the magistrate at the time reached a decision that there was a level of control and coercion from her husband.
Mm.
So when I heard these similar arguments popping up again about the need to care for a child, there is the controlling elements of the men in support of Islamic State, you know, I was preparing myself for either way. So, yeah, look, it would boil down to the seriousness of the charges again and the seriousness of the allegations.
Mm.
And ultimately, the Chief Magistrate was just not satisfied that we'd hit those, quote, exceptional circumstances this time around.
Yeah. Interesting, James, in the case of Zainab and Corsair Ahmed, that they're not charged with terror offences at this stage. The magistrate, even, you know, in the bail hearing of Corsair Ahmed, even highlighted this fact to the prosecution team that, you know, there's this whole conversation around risk, around terrorism risk, but at this point, she's not charged with terrorism offences. And I mean, it's not uncommon for people to be charged with other offences as a process like this unfolds, is it?
No, and you know, the police can lay charges anytime they want when they feel they have enough evidence, and obviously the prosecution is happy to proceed with that. You know, even with all the recent returnees, you know, we talked a little bit before in the previous episode about the two women who returned from Lebanon last year. They crossed over from another Syrian camp into Lebanon. They were smuggled across with children. And so Rayan Al-Houli was charged just a few weeks back, yet she arrived last year, and the federal police made the point that it was because of the recent returnees they were able to get that little bit of extra evidence that they needed to proceed with charges.
Mm.
So this is certainly not the end of the road necessarily for anyone that's come back. They'll keep examining the evidence and what becomes available. And that could mean more charges for one person, or it could be another person who hasn't been charged is charged.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep everyone up to date here on the case of. James, I really appreciate you joining us and taking us through all the details of Zainab and Khosa Ahmed's bail applications.
Thank you.
We'll be back in your feed on Tuesday next week. There is a trial that is not long finished that I think a lot of you will be really interested in. And a lot of you have already been emailing us about emails to thecaseof@abc.net.au. This is the trial of Timothy Loosemore, who was accused of murdering Marie Vermont. That's a woman that he met when he stayed at her Airbnb. It started in very, very dramatic trial, something I'd never seen before in the first days of this trial. So we'll tell you all about it on Tuesday. The Case of the ISIS Brides is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. This episode was reported by James Oden and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Wurundjeri people.